Okay. Any other? Nobody else? Yeah, you missed that last night. I don't even know what agency pulled me over last night. That's the funny thing. I forget that. Anything else that you really wanted to hear? Get out of this. I know a lot of people mentioned yesterday they want to hear about funding opportunities. Anybody have anything else? What did you really want to hear? Because I've got a lot of different stories. I don't know if any of it's going to be of interest to you generally. Did you have something? Okay. All right. The two points that I really wanted to get across, first of all, one is to sort of, I know a lot of academics sometimes get free rides to these conferences just by going up and giving a talk on what hackers really are, sort of telling us what we already know. The point I want to get across is that when I'm talking about hackers, and then when most people in the academic community taking the non-criminal aspect of things are talking about hackers, that we're not talking about criminals or people with criminal intent. But I think a lot of the people who come to these conferences and who are here and who want to learn are people who are trying to be real innovators. And that a lot of you who know something about hacker history, as it's promoted in the Jargon File and Stephen Levy's books and a bunch of other academic texts that have come out about hackers, is saying that, you know, this whole community is what's really responsible for all of the technical innovations that throughout the world that people are using to better communicate, to better express themselves, and to better get the things in daily life that they have to do done. And then I think now, especially with all the rhetoric about the war on terror, about how you have a lot of cultures that previously were isolated that are coming into what's becoming a much more flat world, you know, are starting to come into increasing contact with each other. And that I think that this community, and I know other people, Rick Forno would agree with me on this. I forgot his name. Oh, crap. And this is too early to give a talk like this. but they would agree that I think hackers in this community is actually the first line of defense against a lot of the things that are being done maliciously. And I think just the term hacker has become more synonymous with criminal. And I think a lot of that, and people might disagree with me on this, but I think a lot of that actually comes from the sort of mysterious hacker-criminal element that some of us, you know, like to throw out there. You know, we like people to be afraid, you know, of hackers. Oh, we can read your email. Oh, we can, you know, destroy your website if you piss us off. And I think a lot of that comes from the more immature side of things, you know, when people are younger and they're just starting to find out about these things and their minds are more aware and ready to play with the technology, that, you know, they realize they have a certain sense of power but yet don't have the maturity to really know what to do and how to use that power most effectively. And so I think because of that sort of rogue sort of element, the whole defacing scene and things like that, a term which used to be used with a lot of pride to describe an attitude towards innovation, to describe an attitude towards making things better for no socio-commercial purpose, just to make things work more efficiently, to be able to use technology much more effectively, has sort of turned in, you know, through this power ethos into a criminal thing. And that when you read USA Today, when you read all of the popular literature, people, you know, equate hacker with criminal. And one of the things that I'd like the community to focus on, you know, sort of trying to recapture that term hacker. You know, a lot of minorities in this country have recaptured terms that used to be used with a lot of derision. You know, the African American community through the hip hop community has sort of recaptured the N-word, you know, as a way of pride, as a way of marking themselves as a community. The queer community has recaptured the term queer, you know, which used to be a very, very derisive term and a very insulting term, and used that and turned that into something prideful. And I think the hacker community really needs to focus on recapturing that term and making it synonymous with innovation and making it synonymous with making the world a better place, as opposed to leaving it, you know, as a term that's more equated with criminals and the criminal ethos. And sort of dovetailing from that point, getting to the core of the text that I wanted to discuss this morning, was that hackers need to emerge from the shadows a little bit more and more actively engage in the academic research community. just going back to the history of the Hacker Foundation, for those of you that don't know, I'm the treasurer of the Hacker Foundation. I'm one of the co-founders with Jesse Krems. Jesse's going to be speaking today at 5 o'clock. And for those of you who are interested in more of the nuts and bolts specifics on, you know, how to make your project legitimate, how to get 501c3 status, how to get grant funding and things like that, Jesse's going to go into the specifics of those, run you through an example, and tell you more about how to do that. This is more of an ethereal talk. These are just the ideas that I've been, you know, floating around for the past 3 or 4 years that I've been involved with the Hacker Foundation. And you know, just part of grabbing from the hacker term and going into research that I really think that, you know, we need to start acting more like a research community than just sort of a bunch of people playing around in a garage. Because I think just, you know, I've been involved in this community for at least, you know, at this point, almost a decade. I'm probably a little bit older than, you know, a lot of the younger people here in the audience. And I've seen people who started out when they were 6, 7 years old, you know, playing around with computers. I was one of those people. I had one of those old Texas Instruments with a cartridge and a speech synthesizer. And I was sitting there, and that's the computer that I learned BASIC on. And I see a lot of these really, really talented people who start out going into things, you know, first they start learning for themselves, then they start sharing that knowledge with other people. And then they sort of get involved in the hacker community and what has evolved and become the open source community. And they're really interested in just making things better. That, you know, when you're still living in your parents' house and you don't have to think about economic needs and you have that little freedom time before the time that you turn 18, people are innovating, that they do a lot of really great work in them. But then, you know, they reach 18, they go off to college or they get kicked out of their parents' house and they realize, oh, I have to work. You know, I have to actually get a paycheck, I have to feed myself, I have to pay the rent, I have to pay all of my bills. And that a lot of the spirit of innovation that they had while they were working, you know, in their bedrooms and when they were working in their parents' house sort of disappears, that they think, all right, well, I was doing a lot of this work for the community before, but now, you know, I need to get paid. You know, I need to go out there. And a lot of the most talented people that I've seen who even went to college and were doing a lot of really great research and contributing a lot to the community in college have gone off and started working for corporate enterprise. And, you know, a lot of them go into it with the best intentions. They say, well, you know, when I was going over the offer there, they said that I'd still be able to continue working on my projects. They said that I'd still be able to contribute code back out to the community. But as anyone who's worked in a corporate environment before, they know that when you're working for them, you are working for them. You are serving their economic interests. And increasingly, as you move up in corporations, especially now that all the dot-com money has dried up, that a lot of the more charitable educational aspects of these things have been converted to pure business purposes. That when you're out there, when you're writing code specifically for your employers. A lot of times, even if you're allowed to share it, if you share it with the community, it doesn't have a really good convertible outside use. That it's for them. And then when people start getting into relationships, they start getting married, they want to buy houses, and they realize they need to move up. You know, in these corporate organizations, they realize that I just don't have the time anymore to contribute code back to the community. And that there are very, very few corporate enterprises today, and it's even shrinking from the dot-com era, it's continuing to shrink, that we don't see a lot of corporate money going into developing true open source code that's portable and that serves many different needs in the community. What was that? Okay. Is it still on? Am I still on? God, just hello? Is that a little better? Okay. All right. No worries. So, to take you back a little bit, the year is 2002. We were at DEF CON, I think, 10, was it?
9.
Okay, it's DEF CON 9. The previous year, I had actually given a talk based on some research that I had done at the University of Michigan about human-computer interaction. I got to know Jesse at the time. He was the only speaker goon at DEF CON, and we sort of got to chatting about human-computer interaction, and the conversation led to humanitarian work that hackers could be doing. And he said, you know, we've got Doctors Without Borders, you've got Journalists Without Borders. You know, it would be really cool if we had an organization that was more like Hackers Without Borders. And I thought that was a really good idea, because I think that a lot of the work that hackers do can be specifically geared towards more humanitarian-oriented projects. You know, helping people in Africa communicate better, helping work with really patchwork networks that professionals in the field really don't know what to do with because it's not in their operations manual. They don't have a flowchart for how to make an X501 network out of a copper wire fence, which is how a lot of communications in Africa was done until very recently. And so Jesse and I took the Hackers Without Borders idea, and we started developing it, and we started talking to other people in the community. And what a lot of people in the community then were talking about was, well, you know, that sounds like a really great idea. You know, I tried to get a research project going, and I tried to get grant funding, and then I filled everything out, and the people who were willing to give me the grant, they were really excited about the idea until they asked me what organization I work for. And I said, well, they said, well, I don't work for an organization. I work out of my garage. You know, I have a side job, which is completely unrelated to tech. And even though they were really excited and they really wanted to fund me, I didn't have an organization that would watch over the funds, that would make sure that I was spending them responsibly. And so I lost out on a lot of this grant funding. And this is the same story that we started hearing over and over and over again, that there was no organization or foundation out there that would specifically help people who are not otherwise affiliated with the research community get grant funding, administer grant funding, and help them work on the projects that they were doing in their own garages and in their houses. And then, so the idea started out as Hackers Without Borders, and they thought, you know, there's a much bigger need we feel in the community right now, that we need to have sort of an umbrella organization that will allow people who aren't otherwise affiliated in academics or in the corporate sphere get and use the grant funding that's out there. Because there are a lot of different grants out there that I think a lot of people in this room would qualify for, but they can't use them because they don't have that umbrella organization. Another thing we found is that people who are very technically skilled and willing to use those skills for the better good of the community are absolutely horrible at managing their finances. That one of the reasons that I think I became an accountant was to help a lot of my friends just do very simple tax work and do very simple bookkeeping, because for some reason, this probably could be a great academic paper out there, but I still can't find out why hackers are so bad at balancing their checkbook. It's really bad. And so Jesse and I, we went into DEF CON, and we were just talking. We said, you know, we need to have a meeting. We need to sit down with a bunch of people here. We've got people coming from all over the globe. You know, let's sit down and get ideas going. Let's see what we can do about this. And so we invited a bunch of different people. One of those was Priest, who is, you know, the head MC, big guy at DEF CON. We all went out to pizza right before DEF CON. And we were just talking about, you know, all the different things that we need to do, a lot of the problems that are going out there in the community. We said, you know, we need to find some way to, you know, make it so that we can do all these different things and everything can be going, and that, you know, the real battle is, you know, all these people are trying to put us down, you know, stick to the man. At this time I was an undergrad, so I was pulling the whole liberal, you know, the man is trying to put us down rhetoric. And he told us, you know, the real challenge is not fighting the man so much as it is going legit. Because, believe it or not, it is actually much, much, much easier to get what you want done through the law than it is to try to go around the law. And again, this goes back to the whole hacker criminal ethic, that when you give people the chance to go through a bunch of different regulations and to get things done, or to just do it on the side outside of the system, I think the hacker community is much more prone to go outside of the system than to learn the regulations and to do all the different things and to do the due diligence, which is exactly what Priest was telling us to do. And so that's when the Hacker Foundation as an entity really started to take shape. He said, you know, you need to go back home, start an organization, find out what the law is, go and get it done. And that's exactly what we did. I was living in California at the time, and a lot of our core constituents were living in California at the time. And so we started the Hacker Foundation as a California corporation. It's very easy to do. The state of California loves nonprofit organizations. Administrators in the state of California were really, really helpful. And even though the paperwork took a long time to push through, because California is a very administrative-heavy state, we got our California corporation and nonprofit status relatively easily. And so the next logical step after becoming a corporation was applying for 501c3 status, which, for those of you who don't know, is the part of the Internal Revenue Code that basically makes nonprofits nonprofits. When you see other nonprofits going out there and saying this, you know, when you make a donation to us, we're a 501c3 organization, you can write it off in your taxes. That is really, really big. I know almost every project that's out there has a PayPal donation button, and a lot of them came to us saying, you know, they ask us, are you 501c3? You know, can we write this off on our taxes? And, of course, they didn't know what 501c3 was. Well, no, you're just giving to our project because we need the money. And when corporations hear that, they say, you know, we love your code. It's fantastic. It's open source. We're using it in our organization. But, you know, I can't really convince the CFO to give you any money. Sorry. And it ended right there. And so people are saying, you know, how do we go about getting this? I don't know anything about the law. I went to an attorney. I can't afford to pay him, you know, $250 an hour to start me up and to get everything going on this. And so that's when Jesse and I said, you know, yeah, we really have to do this. We have to go out and get the status for the community. So after we became a California corporation, I flew out to Vermont, Jesse and I. We went through the big pile of IRS paperwork, the big application form that asks a lot of technical questions, that asks a lot of financial-related questions. And, you know, the federal government, if they're going to give an organization the ability to write off donations to it on people's taxes, they need to collect a lot of information. And we didn't really know at the time what we were doing. When we originally applied to the IRS, we said, well, we want to act as an umbrella organization to the open source community. We filled out all the requisite paperwork, sent it in, and waited. And waited and waited and waited and waited. I think it was 6 or 7 months. And then we get this. It was almost a year. Yeah, so it was almost a year. And then we get a nice long letter back from a revenue officer in California, which basically said, what the fuck? You know, what is this? What is open source? You know, what do you mean? You're going to give hackers money? What's going on here? Which is essentially what we were trying to do. And we spent. And this, they sent us and they asked a lot of very specific, a lot of technical questions about what exactly it was that we were trying to do. Were we working with any other 501c3 organizations? And just one point, if you walk away with, you know, nothing else, it's much, much easier to get 501c3 status when you've already been working with or under an organization that has that status. That many, many, many organizations will split off. And it's much easier to get that status when you say, well, I've been working with the Hacker Foundation, their EIN is this, and, you know, two of the board members that were planning on also sit on the board of the Hacker Foundation. When the IRS reads that, they say, okay, you're good to go. I mean, I've seen it just in seeing how audits are performed with a lot of my clients. If they have all the documentation there and it looks organized and it looks professional, the revenue officer will just sit there, go flip, 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 look at a page, see if it's right, and they say, okay, fine, you're good. Because, I mean, they work for the federal government. They don't have the time to sit there and go through different things. But when you go into an appointment with the IRS and you don't have your paperwork and you don't have everything organized and you can't justify everything that you put on your tax return, that's when things get bad. So we had this letter from the IRS, and we had to go through yet another soul-searching process answering all of the very specific questions. Well, you know, tell me about this project that we had that was a theoretical project. About getting the open source community that was involved in robotics, interested and organized and collaborated around the idea of robotics and devices that would detect and defuse landmines. It was a really great idea. The IRS really liked it, but the way that we had originally couched it was too simple. They wanted more documentation. They wanted to say, well, what specifically are you doing here? What's the exempt purpose that's being served by this project? Another project that we said we wanted to try to get people to donate hardware. You know, companies have a very short life cycle for a lot of their technology. It's 2 or 3 years, even though that technology may have a 5 or 6 year applicable life. Well, first of all, as I'm going through this, am I losing anybody with the terminology that I'm using? You guys, you're still following along pretty well? Because I can sometimes go off and talk about things and not explain them very well. And if I do, just please stop me, and there'll be a question and answer period after this. And they said, well, you know, there are a lot of companies that are out there collecting computers and giving them away to poor people, giving them away to schools. Why do you want to give them away to hackers? And so we actually had to explain that there are development projects that are in play out there in the field and that a lot of the open source community relies on donated hardware to do these things. And it's very difficult for an independent researcher or independent research group that's not a 501c3 organization, that's not otherwise organized or not working through a university or another grant funding agency to get that. But a lot of times it's, you know, techies who hang out with those people who, you know, see things that are meant to be recycled in the closet and just take it out, dispose of it, and hand it off personally, sort of under the table to a lot of these groups. And so we said, we want to try to put a stop to that. We want to try to make it so that people who are out there don't have to rely on friends that are already working for companies, or to try to go out there and, build these networks just to get the equipment that they need to do what they do. And so after we put all this through, we spent a long time in this letter. We had it reviewed by Jennifer Granick, who sits on our board and is our legal affairs counselor. And she said, this looks good. I'm sure the IRS is going to like it. I read more case law on nonprofit things because I was just starting to get into accountancy at this point. We sent it in, just sort of held our fingers, and 2 months later, they came back and said, boom, you're a 501c3 organization. That's it. And we were really, really excited. All right, now we're this organization. Now we're really, going to get out there. We're going to change how the community does everything. Everybody's going to go legit. It's going to be wonderful. And then we went back to all the different people that we said, and he said, oh, we're a 501c3 organization. They're like, okay, great, give me money. I was like, no, that's not the point. We don't have money. We're here to help you, go out there and get money. They're like, oh, so give me money. And that's what the Hacker Foundation has been trying to do since getting our 501c3 status. That a lot of our fundraisers are just, small little things that we pull off at hacker conferences like this, that going out there and actually getting money is a difficult thing. Now, a bunch of projects, we've been talking with various different projects that are out there and involved in going back to a lot of the people who said, you need to start this, and told them, well, okay, we started this. We're here. Now, because we're a 501c3 organization, we have a specific obligation to the federal government and to the state of California to prove that you're doing things that serve an exempt purpose, and that we have to get you to document what you're doing. Oh, document papers? Like, oh, no, I was supposed to release version 2.0, 3 months ago, and people are waiting for it. I'm going to go back and work on code and, oh, go get new money. Go buy. So, where are we left at that? But lately, as we've been talking to more and more people, I don't think I can fully disclose what projects that we've been working for right now, but we are actually in the process of helping bring certain coding projects into the Hacker Foundation. And now is a very, very good time, I think, to get in on that. If you have a research project or you're involved in some things, Jesse and I are going to be here today, we're going to be here tomorrow, come talk to us and ask us about a lot of these different things. We have an application process, and the only reason that we have this application, we're asking the bare minimum things that we need to prove to the federal government that you are serving an exempt research purpose. That when you go back and you're thinking about, what's an exempt research purpose? How do I do that? You're basically trying to document for us so that we have the documentation in case the federal government asks us about it, saying that, what I'm doing, the code that I'm producing, the robotics work that I'm doing, the other projects that I have, I'm doing for a charitable purpose. I'm not doing this to make money. I'm not doing this, to be aggrandizing. I'm not doing this because I'm a terrorist. I'm doing it because I'm very interested in doing it. I'm interested in pursuing and enhancing the science behind the field. And I'm not doing it because I want to get a patent on what I'm doing. I'm doing it for the community. Because I know that there's somebody else out there, on the other side of the country, on the other side of the planet, that's going to take the work that I'm doing and make it better. And that I'm probably going to see what he's been doing and have more ideas on how to make his work better. And what I see a lot of people doing is spending a lot of their own wage income on a lot of these things. Some people might have side businesses or side hobbies, and to write off a lot of those things on your taxes, you actually have to have a profit purpose. Independent researchers that are not working for a grant funding organization for a university can't write off the cost of their equipment. They can't depreciate it. They can't write off the cost of their supplies. They can't write off the cost of their labor. They can't do a lot of these things. So they're spending just, up to times 50, 60% of their income pursuing these research projects. And going back to, the 18, 19-year-old kids that are in college or people who are working together, when they start, getting married, when they start having families, when they start looking to buy houses, even though they still have an interest in those research projects, they simply can't pursue them because they don't have the income. The wife says, we have to pay the light bill. We have to pay the phone bill. Quit buying computers. And, if anybody who's been in a relationship like that, when your significant other says, we got to pay these bills, stop buying computers, you generally have a choice. You either have to stop buying computers or break up or get divorced with whoever you're with. That's just how it goes. What we want to do is we want to make it so that everybody here who's involved with the project for a charitable purpose can start using a lot of the laws and a lot of the regulations that are out there to be able to offset a lot of that cost. When you're working with a 501c3 organization and you buy assets, when you use supplies, when you go to conferences and spend money to perfect and go forward with that charitable aspect under the law as it exists now, you have the right to write those expenses off against your taxable income and lower your regular tax bill. And that if you end up, and especially now after Katrina and the laws about that, you can write off much, 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 much more of this, of these things that you're using to buy and to spend, that you're spending on charitable projects against your taxes. That they've opened up many, many, many more regulations, even since Jesse and I started the organization, that allow you to write off a lot more of that on your taxes if you're pursuing it for a charitable purpose. And that's what the Hacker Foundation is here to do. That all you have to do, we've already done all the legal aspects of it, we're well versed in the tax aspects of it. We're here to help you do the research that you're doing and to help you reap the full benefits that are afforded to you under federal law for those different things. Another thing that I mentioned earlier is grant funding. A lot of people out there are, sort of plugged in at the edge and at the fray of the academic research community. And at that edge, there's a lot of grant funding out there. There are a lot of people who have a lot of money that are interested in seeing the open source community bloom and develop. But because they work for organizations and they're 501, they fall under some chapter of 501, either educational, 501CB or 501CD. I think it is, don't quote me on that. They want to give away money to people in the open source community, but they can't give away that money to individuals. They can't just write you a blank check. Sometimes grant people will be able to say, okay, we can give you this piece of equipment, but you have to write us every 3 months to say that this piece of equipment is still here just in case we need to go back and get it. And, if hackers can't balance their checkbook, if they have a hard time, just getting through the daily grind, the basic economics that it takes for people to go about their daily lives, are they going to remember to write a letter every 3 months? Are they going to get just being wrapped up in their project and being divided by so many other things going on in their life, are they going to be able to do a lot of those administrative things? And we found that no, that it's too high of a burden to do that. That's another thing that the Hacker Foundation does. We're here specifically to allow you to go apply for grant funding as individual researchers, as small research groups. And we're here to offset a lot of that administrative burden for you. That as long as you're still pursuing code, as long as you're still pursuing robotics or other electronic projects that are out there for a charitable purpose, we will be here to help you do all the bookkeeping, do all the due diligence, to act as sort of an intermediary between the grant funding organization and you, to make sure that you're fulfilling all of the requisite diligence requirements of the grant organization, but at the same time have as much possible free time as you have to pursue the project and the reason that you're getting the grant funding in the first place. Going back to my first point, another thing that I was really involved in, I wanted to let the Hacker Foundation do, is act as sort of a PR agency. There are a lot of different people out there that claim to speak for hackers and say, I represent the hacker community, I am all this. And I've always found a lot of those people, after a while, they get to be incredibly fake. And they get to be, incredibly wrapped up with their own power. And they say, instead of saying, I'm plugged into the hacker community, I represent the hacker community, they go from, actually talking to people and seeing what's going out, what's going on out there, and saying, okay, well, great, this is what I'm going to tell people. And they get wrapped up in their own ethos and they say, well, I am the hacker community. Whatever I think and whatever I say goes. A good example of this was ESR, right around the time that we went off to war in Iraq. That ESR was, was sort of the voice of the hacker community to a lot of different people. But then when you started espousing a lot of overtly political views that had absolutely nothing to do with the hacker community, he still claimed to speak for hackers and say, oh yeah, we're all for war and we're all against terrorists and things like that. And that it became clear to him after a while that it was obviously not the case. And I think that we've had a couple of these different representatives who have, claimed to speak for them and speak for us, and we find out that no, they get too wrapped up in their own thing, and they speak for themselves. They don't speak for anybody anymore. One of the things that the Hacker Foundation tries to do is to try to get as many people from many different parts of the community together and collaboratively putting together a message that speaks for the hacker community. We're not trying to appoint any one person. You know, I don't personally claim to speak for the hackers. Jesse doesn't claim to speak for it. Jennifer Granick doesn't claim to speak for it. What we try to do in all of our monthly board meetings and every time we get together is to get a sense of what's going on in the community. What are the needs here? You know, are the feds clamping down on us a lot harder than they were? You know, is one federal agency, you know, giving us, you know, slack in some areas, but another federal agency is trying to take away our rights in another area? And, you know, we're not the EFF. We're not the Hacker Defense Fund. What we're trying to operate as is a voice for everybody in the community to put together, to put what they think in, to try to collect all those different ideas and try to come up with a message that at a very baseline we can all agree on. One of the things that I would like to try to do with this whole effort is sort of going back to my first point, recapture the term hacker. You know, when I, and let's say, you know, I'm a hacker, I'm not saying I'm a criminal. I'm not saying that I, you know, through my technical knowledge I'm trying to acquire more power in order to use and put forward, you know, things that I want to try to take down my enemies. No, I'm trying to be an innovator. You know, I'm trying to help a lot of my friends that have an incredible technical talent. I'm trying to help a lot of my friends that have been working on these different things put out there and put out, you know, their knowledge and their skills and to try to make the world a better place. That we see a lot of people who are, you know, quote unquote doing innovation, but are really piling on really crufty things on top of other crufty things and trying to sell it and to trying to push it out there as the latest innovation. That too much of the innovation that we see right now out there in the technical sphere is just what marketing pitch can we, you know, come up with? What bells and whistles and features can we put out there, you know, to sort of make things better and to sell more products so that my stock price goes up so that when I vest, I have more money when I get out? You know, I really hate talking about it. I specifically decided not to pursue technology as a career because I saw what it was doing to a lot of people, especially in the dot-com era. You know, I arrived in San Francisco in 2001, fresh out of college, and a lot of people had a really altruistic viewpoint of the world who wanted to put out code to make the world better were now thinking, well, you know, I have stock options. You know, I have money. I have a paycheck. You know, if my boss tells me to just get this code done, not caring if it's right, just to get it done and get it out there so that, you know, we can hit our quarterly numbers, I'm going to do it. And I was just shocked by this. That money, you got to really watch out for it. Money is a really, really seductive thing. That even though you go into things with the best of intentions, when you get wrapped up in that corporate ethic, you become a part of it. You know, the money is very, very seductive, especially when you start living a certain lifestyle that you become accustomed to. It's really hard to go back. It's so easy to live, you know, much more outside of your means. It's really hard to come back from an extravagant lifestyle to a more simple way of living. So it's kind of unrelated, but just watch out for that. But getting back to my original point, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to use my skills that I'm developing in the accounting sphere to try to be able to get as much possible advantage, both in the grant sphere, both in the nonprofit sphere, to be able to let you guys do what exactly it is that you want to do. And that's basically, you know, the end of my message. Does anybody have any questions specifically, things that they'd like me to go over? Yes.
Universities to develop relationships, you know, just to kind of foster some of this research and some of the ideas and kind of, you know, like a senior class project, that kind of stuff where, you know, there is a group of people in colleges and universities that have great ideas that want to do things to kind of help, you know, third world countries develop better forms of communication and you know, $100 PC and cell phone networks and mention the X500 emailing in third world countries. And there's a, you know, I saw it myself going through college and had a lot of great ideas and a lot of energy and had time to do something with it, but really didn't have a conduit to flow it through or a direction or something. And then we get some funding and, you know, and that kind of thing. We reached out to universities to, you know.
Did you guys all hear his question okay? Over here, did you guys hear his question? He was basically asking, you know, has the Hacker Foundation reached out to colleges and universities to try to, you know, get independent researchers that are working in the academic community grant funding? And no, that's not something that the Hacker Foundation has done. One of the other things that you find out about trying to pursue colleges and universities and in that sphere, I mean, we tried it very, very little bit, but then we're scared away, that universities, even in and of themselves, even though they tend to serve a more altruistic purpose, are political organizations in and of themselves. That when you go in there and when you try to say, well, you know, we'd like to offer your students grant, but no. Any grant funding that comes through this university is ours. We administer it. We have to take care of it because we have certain rules. We have certain things. And it's a very political thing, especially at universities, that it's really hard to help people who are already affiliated with universities and sort of working on the fringes of different projects, either helping out their friends that are officially involved with a lot of research projects. And no, we haven't reached that out specifically. And that, honestly, if you're working within a university, if your research project is in any way supported or funded by a university, the Hacker Foundation is more than willing to help you pile through the grant paperwork that the university puts on you to try to get university-based funding. But because we're specifically, you know, our purpose is to serve the people who are not served by any other organization that's out there, that a lot of the efforts that we're putting out, at least in terms of administering grant funding and helping people do that sort of thing, is dedicated to that avenue. We would love to help you try to write grants and to try to help you pile that on because, you know, universities, even more so than corporations, love paperwork. They love long, flowing statements. They love huge, eight-tier PowerPoint presentations that go through all of the various different wonderful things that your project is trying to accomplish and this, that, and the other. And again, when you throw a 40-page grant application at a hacker, you know, they're going to look at it, they're going to flip through it, they're going to say, you know, really, my time is better spent working on my code than trying to get through this thing, you know, with a lot of language and things like that that I don't really understand. So we're more than willing to help you pile through that 40-page grant application to help you get funding within your university, but as far as, you know, sort of trying to break you out of the university mold, you know, and get you going on your own thing, we try to avoid doing that, you know, in there. But once you're out of college, you know, when you're no longer a student, when you no longer have a lot of the access privileges that you used to have and are trying to get out there and continue to pursue the work that you're doing on your own, we're more than willing to try to help you at that point pick up, you know, the pace and to try to get different funding. Even if it's in some, there's some grants out there that try to fund independent researchers in a way, and we will try to help you get that, but that specifically going into colleges is not something that we're out there and targeting doing. Next question. Somebody else has to have a question. Jesse. Thank you.
I don't know if I could have answered it for them, but I'll ask you. You're developing something in the foundation. Can you spin it off into a for-profit activity after? Could it be like, as it grows and changes?
Okay.
So you come in as a nonprofit, you know, altruistic model, thought process, whatever you want to do, then you're like, wait a second, I just developed like this awesome, like, new cell network.
The question basically was, is if you're an independent researcher and going out there doing independent research, can you take, you know, what you've been doing and then you sort of drift off into a for-profit model? That's a complicated legal question, but the simple answer is no. But here's a couple of different things. If you're learning a lot of the processes and getting much more adept, you know, if you've ever written code and you've written code for a long time, that just through the process of troubleshooting and getting code more optimized, more efficient, you realize that the more you code, the better of a coder that you become. A lot of those skills that you're building and developing things in the nonprofit sphere are things that you can easily leverage and go out and use to get a job in the corporate sphere. So the yes answer to the question in that way is the skill that you're developing, some of the technology and the expertise in the field that you're developing in the nonprofit sphere is something that makes you more marketable. But if you develop a specific method or a specific patent while ostensibly serving a nonprofit exempt purpose, you have to give that back to the community. That under the open source development model, if you come up with an innovation like that, you're legally bound through various different licensing agreements, depending on which ones you're bound under, to give that back, to free it open, and to not try to seek a specific overt profit purpose from that. And a lot of times what I found, people who have tried to do that and tried to get through the law and try to work with attorneys and get things like that end up spending a lot more on attorneys and a lot more on legal processing than they will ever see as a profit coming out of that project. And And, you know, the whole idea behind developing under the nonprofit model, the whole idea that we're here is to try to help you live and maintain that and to try to give as much back to the community as possible, as opposed to trying to develop, you know, one thing for you to be able to get all this grant funding, to be able to, you know, have a PayPal button on your site that people can donate to and get a tax receipt to write off on their taxes for, to then later suddenly decide, okay, I'm going to go for-profit now. That's not what we're here and not what we're here about doing. So that's, I hope that answered the question mostly. Yes?
Did you use a model where the development is already existed, but you make money on supporting the product? Let's say, you know, you come up with WinChat RP, with anyone can download it, it's all free, like fully open source, but people basically hire you for consulting to support the product with your installation, so the product still remains open.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. I mean, offering support for pay under the open source model is perfectly legitimate. But then again, that goes back to the fact that you have a certain level of expertise with the product that you're, even though you may not be collecting a W-2 from a corporation, you still have the marketability to go out there and get money for supporting the product and for teaching people how to use it. What I'm saying is that you can't make money off of the product or try to close the source or to try to take a development branch and use that development branch and sell the fruits of that development branch. You can always sell support. You know, there are a lot of people who are going to be willing and out there to pay you to, you know, help build certain things, help install certain things, help, you know, sort of customize and tweak, going through a lot of the complicated comp files to get it working for them. But another thing that I found is that the hacker community really is not that interested in providing tech support. You know, I've been frontline, third tier, second tier, end manager level tech support, and it is one of the worst jobs that's out there. I'm never going to go back and do that. Actually, that reminds me of an anecdote. When I was working for a department at the University of Michigan, I think we had just rolled out the version of Office where Clippy came up automatically. And first, and just in one install, one build, we had normally, it was normal policy to take that out of all of our builds just to make them a little bit easier. But, you know, we had sent one new guy to do a build for a specific version of, for another Dell computer that we had, just a ghost image basically, and he forgot to take that out. Well, so a secretary gets a new computer, you know, she fires it up and everything like that, and, you know, Clippy pops up and Clippy winks at her. And the university, being the political organization is, she decides to file a sexual harassment complaint against the computer. I'm not kidding you about this. I actually had to go into a sexual harassment hearing representing the technology department that I was working for and defend Clippy. No, I mean, really, I mean, there are some people, and this is getting recorded, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but... No, there are people at universities that have so much time on their hands that, and have such a large foreign object lodged where the sun don't shine that they actually have time to go filing sexual harassment complaints against Clippy. And it was brutal. The administrative hearing that was held, they were attacking, you know, me and my department personally for, how could you do this? How could you allow such a sexist thing to be on the computer? I'm like, we'll take it off. Please, can this just be over? And, you know, going back to the original point that, yeah, hackers, I don't think, are that interested in doing tech support. But if you want to go out there and make money doing tech support, be my guest. More power to you. You know. Was there another question? Who does? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Say you are a developer that's kind of hit the point where you say, okay, I'm at the level that I'm doing something, I need some extra help. What's the next process? Maybe just pick up the phone, call the Hacker Foundation, have like a conference, say, hey, I'm this guy, I'm doing this stuff. Does it go through like a committee? Do you put together some sort of information bundle and say, here's what I'm doing. How the hell do you guys help me? Where do you go?
Actually, that's exactly what we do. The question was, I already pitched your talk at 5. For those of you who came in late, a lot of the specifics and the nuts and bolts of applying, trying to apply for project status under the Hacker Foundation, sort of 501c3 in a box, Jesse at 5 o'clock, I believe in this room, is going to be giving a talk that covers more of the specific aspects. Oh, he's in the other room? I'm sorry, he's going to be at 5 o'clock in the other room. He's going to take you through the process of applying to the Hacker Foundation so that you can try to get a lot of these advantages that we specifically set out to do. But to briefly answer your question, yes, that's what you do. You email us, you submit an application, and since we're plugged in with a lot of other different networks, both formally and informally, the first thing that we'll try to do is see, okay, well, where can you get exempt status from here? What sort of advantages under the federal code can we provide you with right away? But beyond that, you know, just legal and tax expertise is not the only thing that the Hacker Foundation does. That we have people, you know, throughout the world. We've got people in England. We've got people in East Asia. We have people here in the United States. We've got people here in Canada. And through a lot of the formal informal networks that we have, we can link you with other developers, maybe that aren't seeking specific status, but we can at least plug you into different communities where you can get more of the help and more of the advice that you need. Because I know even just filtering through all of the different open source projects that are out there, just all of the crap that's on SourceForge, FreshMeat, and it's hard to find, okay, well, you know, these guys are kind of doing what I'm doing, but they've got a different development branch. You know, I'm more Linux-based, I'm more BSD-based. There's a lot of political infighting, which is another thing that the hacker, I don't want to get into that too much, but I think that as a research community, we really need to stop with all the politics and the political infighting. We all have a common goal, that just because your development branch broke off from my development branch 3 splits ago does not mean that we can't work together. And just I'd sort of when you go back home, just sort of think about how you can work together instead of, you know, how can I get my camp over this other camp? Because that's not helping anybody. But when you apply with the Hacker Foundation, getting back to your question, in addition to the support, you know, both on the tax side and both on the code side, or federal code side, we do try to link all of our researchers and put them together and try to help them work together. Because it's really lonely out there being an independent developer. Even if we can just hook you up with one other person that's doing one other thing that's very targeted to what you're doing, that's a tremendous help that we've found. And that's another thing we do. A lot of other things we do are branding and marketing. You know, maybe you're not the best person putting together a flashy web page. We have people that help you do that, you know, in a simple way. We help you get the PayPal donation button set up and to try to, you know, see what your informal network is right now. How can you formalize that? How can you get more donations out of the people that want to help you but can't because of that administrative barrier that they have both, you know, in their grant funding organizations and in their corporations. All right. How am I doing? Okay, I got just a couple minutes left. Anybody else have any specific questions or even questions about things that... Yeah, Froggy.
Nick, a lot of what you said has really resonated with me, especially using wage income to run projects, basically. What I do with iPod.
Dude, I have no idea why you like to ask S-Corp status. That was a dumb idea, but... Okay.
I guess my question is, can that be changed? Do you think there would be any advantage for more conferences like Nauticon and others out there working under the Hacker Foundation to get 501c3 status, to be able to take donations and grants, so that we can run these events without worrying about how I'm going to afford my mortgage then?
No, that's one of the things that actually we're working on for a project, which I can't really talk about right now, is how can we get sort of hackathons funded? How can we bring a lot of people who are developing in all different parts of the world, get them together in one place where they can get, you know, face-to-face networking so that they can actually look at code on each other's screens, get things together and actually talk in real time face-to-face and working things better. And that's one of the projects that we're working on is how can we bring developers who are developing in all these different parts of the globe and get them, you know, to meet each other in a lot of cases for the first time face-to-face without breaking the bank. And that there are a lot of, you know, it's a really sort of fuzzy gray area in the tax code, but there are advantages out there, especially in the nonprofit sphere. And there's actually grant funding in a lot of ways that even universities will sometimes pick up the tabs if you can bring independent researchers in to talk with the researchers that are there at the universities. And there are a lot of really cheap conference spaces and a lot of really cheap flights and ways to travel, especially when you book in groups or have group code booking, that just aren't available to the public that we're developing as a foundation to try to get people working more together. You know, we don't throw cons, that's more your expertise, but when it comes to small conferences and getting developers together, that's one of the things that we're working on and trying to make available to the community.
I realize that my strength is the logistics of pulling this off, but the business side has always been a real challenge. And I know there's a better way to do it, so maybe by working together.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. And that's why we're here, to not only serve you, but to try to bring you together with other people that can, you know, better serve you, and to try to build a better community. That's why we started the Hacker Foundation. You know, we're here specifically, we are here for this community. If there's things that you want us to do that we're not doing, come and tell us, and we'll try to do them. You know, we've got an incredible talent pool on our board. We have a lot of people that are in the community that are actively working with us. And we're not project or focus specific. You know, like I said, we aren't the EFF. We're not the Hacker Defense Fund. We don't have one specific idea in mind. We're here to try to be as representative a body for the community and try to get the community some respect in the outside world that it's deserved for a long time. But because, you know, hackers are hackers specifically because they don't, you know, work perfectly well in the outside world and know exactly how things flow, you know, in all the various different complicated political arenas, that, you know, we're here to try to be that bridge for the community. And that we're here to try to represent you. I'm not up here saying, you know, I know everything. I don't claim to speak for the hacker community. What I try to do is represent your interests and do those things like that. And I just want to give a quick disclaimer. I am not a CPA yet. I sit for the exam in July. Don't take any of this as tax or legal advice that's actionable, that I strongly recommend. That until you're working with the Hacker Foundation officially, don't take anything I've said and use that to go about filling out your tax returns. Speak with a qualified legal or tax representative before you make any actionable decisions. Oh, crap, you didn't stop recording right then and there in the middle of me saying that, did you? Okay, now I've got, I think, Froggy, do I have time for just one more question if someone has it out there?
Sure, why not?
Okay. Anybody have one more? No. No, I'm still doing a lot of my clients' taxes. That's why I was only able to spend a couple minutes at the party, 522 last night. Again, if you have any other questions, maybe you're a little bit nervous to talking from a crowd. Jesse, could you stand up real quickly? You know, Jesse Krems is here. He's going to be talking at 5 in the other room. I'm available all throughout the con if you have simple questions about your project or what you'd like to try to do, or things that you think the Hacker Foundation should be doing, please come talk to me. Also, we have two members of our board here. William, will you stand up? William Knowles, he runs InfoSec News, C4I.org. He's on our board. And Curiosity, he's here, Curiosity.org. He's also Christian Wright. He's also on our board. Thank you very much. It's been a good time. Enjoy the rest of Nauticon.